The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells. Chapter 12. The Invisible Man Loses His Temper. It is unavoidable that at this point the narrative should break off again, for a certain very painful reason that will presently be apparent. While these things were going on in the parlor, and while Mr. Huckster was watching Mr. Marvel smoking his pipe against the gate, not a dozen yards away were Mr. Hall and Teddy Henfrey discussing in a state of cloudy puzzlement the one ipping topic. Suddenly there came a violent thud against the door of the parlor, a sharp cry, and then silence.
"Hello,"
said Teddy Henfrey.
"Hello,"
from the tap. Mr. Hall took things in slowly but surely. "That ain't right," he said, and came round from behind the bar to see the parlor door. He and Teddy approached the door together, with intent faces, their eyes considered.
"Simit wrong," said Hall,
and Henfrey nodded in agreement. Whiffs of an unpleasant chemical odor met them. There was a muffled sound of conversation, very rapid and subdued.
"You are right there?"
asked Hall, rapping. The muttered conversation ceased abruptly for a moment, silence, then the conversation was resumed in hissing whispers, then a sharp cry of,
"No, no, you don't!"
There came a sudden motion, and the oversetting of a chair, a brief struggle, silence again.
"What the deuce?"
exclaimed Henfrey, sotto voce.
"You all right there?"
asked Mr. Hall sharply again. The vicar's voice answered with a curious jerking intonation.
"Quite right. Please don't interrupt."
"Odd,"
said Mr. Henfrey.
"Odd," said Mr. Hall.
"Cease, don't interrupt,"
says Henfrey.
"I heard'n," said Hall.
"Under sniff,"
said Henfrey. They remained listening, but the conversation was rapid and subdued.
"I can't," said Mr. Bunting, his voice rising. "I tell you, sir, I will not." "What was that?"
asked Henfrey.
"Says he won't not," said Hahn. "Won't speak in Joyce, was he?"
"Disgraceful,"
said Mr. Bunting within.
"Disgraceful,"
said Mr. Henry. "I heard it distinct."
"Who's that speaking now?" asked Henfrey.
"Mr. Cuss, I suppose," said Hall. "Can you hear anything?" Silence. The sounds with indistinct and perplexing.
"Sounds like they're throwing the tablecloth about," said Hall.
Mrs. Hall appeared behind the bar. Hall made gestures of silence and invitation. This aroused Mrs. Hall's wifey opposition.
"What are you listening for, Hall?" she asked. "Ain't you nothing better to do, busy day like this?"
Hall tried to convey everything by grimaces and dumb show, but Mrs. Hall was obdurate. She raised her voice, so Hall and Henfrey, rather crestfallen, tiptoed back to the bar, gesticulating, trying to explain to her. At first she refused to see anything in what they had heard at all. Then she insisted on Hall keeping silence while Henfrey told her his story. She was inclined to think the whole business nonsense. Perhaps they were just moving the furniture about.
"I heard her say disgraceful. That I did," said Hall.
"I heard that, Mrs. Hall," said Henfrey.
"Like he's not," began Mrs. Hall.
"Hush," said Mr. Teddy Henfrey. "Didn't I hear the window?"
"What window?" asked Mrs. Hall.
"Parlour window," said Henfrey.
Everyone stood listening intently. Mrs. Hall's eyes, directed straight before her, saw without seeing the brilliant oblong of the inn door, the road white and vivid, and Huckster's shop front blistering the June sun. Abruptly, Huckster's door opened and Huckster appeared, eyes staring with excitement, arms gesticulating.
"Yap!"
cried Huckster.
"Stop thief!"
And he ran obliquely across the oblong towards the yard gates and vanished. Simultaneously came a tumult from the parlour, and a sound of windows being closed. Hall, Henfrey, and the human contents of the tap rushed out at once pell-mell into the street. They saw someone whisk around the corner towards the road, and Mr. Huckster executing a complicated leap in the air that ended on his face and shoulder. Down the street people were standing, astonished or running towards them. Mr. Huckster was stunned. Henfrey stopped to discover this, but Hall and the two laborers from the tap rushed at once to the corner, shouting incoherent things, and saw Mr. Marvel vanishing by the corner of the church wall. They appeared to have jumped to the impossible conclusion that this was the Invisible Man suddenly become visible, and sent off at once in the lane to the pursuit. But Hall had hardly run a dozen yards before he gave a loud shout of astonishment and went flying headlong sideways, clutching one of the laborers and bringing him to the ground. He had been charged just as one charges a man at football. The second laborer came around in a circle, stared, and conceiving that Hull had tumbled over of his own accord, turned to resume the pursuit, only to be tripped by the ankle just as Huckster had been. Then, As the first laborer struggled to his feet, he was kicked sideways by a blow that might have felled an ox. As he went down, the rush from the direction of the village green came round the corner. The first to appear was the proprietor of the coconut shy, a burly man in a blue jersey. He was astonished to see the lane empty save for three men, sprawling absurdly on the ground. And then something happened to his rearmost foot, and he went headlong and rolled down sideways, just in time to graze the feet of his brother and partner, following headlong. The two men were then kicked, knelt on, fallen over, and cursed by quite a number of overhasty people. Now when Hall and Henfrey and the laborers ran out of the house, Mrs. Hall, who had been disciplined by years of experience, remained in the bar next to the till. And suddenly the parlor was opened, and Mr. Cuss appeared, and without glancing at her, rushed at once down the steps toward the corner. "Hold him," he cried. "Don't let him drop the parcel." He knew nothing of the existence of Marvel, for the invisible man had handed over the books and bundle in the yard, and the face of Mr. Cuss was angry and resolute, but his costume was defective, a sort of limp white kilt that could have only passed muster in Greece. "Hold him," he bawled. "He's got my trousers and every inch of the vicar's clothes." "Tend to him in a minute," he cried to Henfrey as he passed the prostrate Hexter, and coming around the corner to join the tumult, was promptly knocked off his feet into an indecorous sprawl. Somebody in full flight trod heavily on his finger. He yelled, struggled to regain his feet, was knocked against and thrown off on all fours again, and became aware that he was involved not in a capture, but a rout. Everyone was running back to the village. He rose again and was hit severely behind the ear. He staggered off and set off back to the coach and horses forthwith, leaping over the deserted huckster, who was now sitting up, on his way. Behind him, as if he was halfway up the inn steps, he heard a sudden yell of rage, rising sharply out of the confusion of cries and a sounding smack in someone's face. He recognized the voice as that of the invisible man, and the note was that of a man suddenly infuriated by a painful blow. In another moment, Mr. Cuss was back in the parlor. "He's coming back, Bunting," he said, rushing in. "Save yourself." Mr. Bunting was standing in the window, engaged in an attempt to clothe himself in the hearth rug and a West Surrey Gazette.
"Who's coming?"
he said, so startled that his costume narrowly escaped disintegration.
"Invisible man," said Cuss, and rushed to the window. "We'd better clear out from here. He is fighting mad, mad."
In another moment he was out in the yard.
"Good heavens,"
said Mr. Bunting, hesitating between two horrible alternatives. He heard a frightful struggle in the passage of the inn, and his decision was made. He clambered out of the window, adjusted his costume hastily, and fled up the village as fast as his fat little legs would carry him. From the moment when the invisible man screamed with rage, and Mr. Bunting made his memorable flight up the village, it became impossible to give a consecutive account of affairs in Iping. Possibly, the invisible man's original intention was simply to cover Mr. Marvel's retreat with the clothes and books, but his temper, at no time very good, seems to have gone completely at some chance blow, and forthwith he set to smiting and overthrowing for the mere satisfaction of hurting. You must figure the street full of running figures, of doors slamming and fights for hiding places. You must figure the tumult suddenly striking on the unstable equilibrium of old Fletcher's planks and two chairs, with cataclysmic results. You must figure in an appalled couple caught dismally in a swing, and then the whole tumultuous rush had passed, and the Iping street with its gods and flags, its deserted save for the still raging unseen, and littered with coconuts, overthrown canvas screens, and the tattered skock in trade of a sweetstuff stall. Everywhere there's a sound of closing shutters and shoving bolts, and the only visible humanity is the occasional flitting eye under a raised eyebrow in the corner of a windowpane. The invisible man amused himself for a little while by breaking all the windows in the coach and horses, and then he thrust a street lamp through the parlor window of Mrs. Gribble. He, it must have been, who cut the telegraph wire to Aderdeen, just beyond Higgins's cottage on the Aderdeen Road, and after that, as his peculiar qualities allowed, he passed out of human perceptions altogether, and he was never heard, seen, nor felt in Iping any more. He vanished absolutely. It was the best part of 2 hours before any human being ventured out into the desolation of Iping Street. End of chapter 12. Read by David Russell. For Lit2Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.